So let me say first a traditional thank you to the organizers for inviting me. Today I'm presenting you some things which have to do with some specific field theoretical approach to disordered systems, systems of Squanch disorder, and avalanche size distributions. I will spend most of the time in the elementary and the basics, because you're probably not familiar with that. I'm going to do this on the board. So this is an ongoing research effort with my colleague Pierre Le Dussel from Paris and a bunch of other people involved in more specific parts of the of this project. So here I show you one experiment. That's the type of experiment I like to do. So I can, for instance, take this this bottle of water, and you see a line which is a contact line here. So the question is, when I drill a hole in here and the water flows out, so this contact line here will be slowly advancing. Well, the bottle is certainly not a pure object. It's dirty, disordered, and what happens then is what you see here. So this is a slightly different setup. So it's a plate which is pushed into the liquid. So when you see just a slow drifting motion, that means that the contact line is pinned on the substrate, and you move it in. So the camera is standing is fixed, and the plate is moving in. So that's a slow motion you see. But then you see a rapid motion. So for instance, here we had a big blob coming up here, another one, and they happen very quickly. So I'm driving at this at very slow speed. They happen very quickly, rapidly, and it's a collective phenomenon. It takes not just a little piece, but seeing that when the contact line depends, it checks behind itself other parts of the interface. So the signal you get out, and this is the experimental signal, is well, when nothing happens, so you just have the plate advancing, you get a straight line which is inclined with an inclination which is just the driving velocity, and then all of a sudden you have these jumps. Here I've colored a couple of them. I mean, here there are much more. There are little jumps at the scale, the resolution of the screen here, and then there are the big jumps. And this big jump I call an avalanche. It happens in a lot of different types of systems. You can take a piece of metal and metal, glass, whatever you want, and you break it, and there's the crack front, which you can in some cases even see, which is advancing. So there's a very beautiful experiment done in Norway, where you have two sheets of plexi. I mean, these rather thick. You glue them together, you sinter them, and then you break them open. You can see where it has broken open. It's a two-dimensional system. I mean, effectively a two-dimensional system is just this. I mean, it will break where you have glued it together. You don't glue, you center it together slightly. So it will break there. And you can record this, and you can record it here. Then there are other systems like magnets, a domain wall and a ferromagnet. I'm going to draw this on the board in a minute when I define the model. This is also the same kind of phenomenon. And you have also the domain wall advancing by not continuously, but in these kind of jumps. So the question is, can we make a theory for this? A theory which is sensitive to these large avalanches. and which captures the universal behavior if there is some in there. Okay.
So the examples you had in the previous slide were fairly specific.
Yeah, this is, I showed you one experiment. Okay, yeah, this is for the, well, who wants to know what the actual system is? You see, this is the signal. I mean, I can show you the data analysis.
This one is that.
So this one is that. They also did hydrogen on the disorder cesium substrate. The signal looks the same. It's actually a little bit cleaner. And there is some universal function in there, which I will define and explain. You can also do experiments on that. And the astonishing thing is that these systems, which are rather different, they still give the same kind of physics. So let me move to the board. Yeah, it should actually be lifted up much, much slower. So when they started their experiments, they did it with 1200 micrometers per second, and then they did 100, and then 10, and then I forced them to do 1, and I was still not happy. I wanted to have 0.1. Well, I didn't get it, so it's a theorist who wants something. Okay, so this chart is awful.
Did you say what the Erlang says the solution was that you saw in the system?
I will come to that. So this is just the motivation. Now we will calculate it and then we compare it again to the experiment. It's approximately, for small sizes, it's the power law S to the minus tau. Tau 3/2 or corrected from there. And the tail is an exponential, which also gets corrected. So just to be specific, here I draw a spin system. Let me draw a domain wall. So that would be an example. You have the spins up and spins down. You have the domain wall in between. So you draw your coordinate system, x, and u of x. And then you go to some long distance effective description of this domain wall. And this is rather standard. You model this by an elastic system, so you write a term like this for the elastic energy. Okay, and I said there is disorder in the system. In a magnet, you can have two types of disorder. You have the nearest neighbor spin coupling, which has a certain strength, and you could imagine, for instance, that this bond here is broken. So then, of course, the domain wall, which costs energy, will like to pass between these bonds. That's one kind of disorder I can have. Or I can have a frozen in spin sitting here, for instance. So this guy would like to turn the neighbors up. So these are the two main kinds of disorder I can have. So this is apparently called random bond disorder. And this guy here called random field disorder. It's just a random field of light, and this is a random bond. But all of them I want to model in the following way. I just add some potential V which is there at position x and u of x. So it's a random potential which is sitting here or which is sitting here. Now, in order to make this description complete, I have to say what the correlations of V are. So V of x and u, V of x prime and u prime. Well, I take V as a Gaussian. So this I will take Gaussian. So it means specifically that it has zero average. Well, you can have an average which you just subtract. It doesn't it doesn't make anything. And I give me the second moment. So I mean, one thing of what I could do, I could say, for instance, take something like a Gaussian x minus x prime square plus u minus u prime square and divide by some length a. So that would be one thing I could be thinking of. Well, let me write something a little bit more abstract. So I take a function, an arbitrary function of x, an arbitrary function of u. Now, when I look at this domain wall, I will find that the correlation function the second moment of the height difference, well, this will scale in general with some exponent zeta, and zeta is usually smaller than 1. So I have a little fluctuations in this direction compared to the linear extension. Well, in that case, it makes sense when I go to a little bit larger scales to take a short range correlated in this direction, but to keep some arbitrary function in the perpendicular direction. So this is a model I'm going to study. Well, this in general d-dimensional. So I take it a short range correlated in this direction, and I take some arbitrary function for the disorder correlator in the perpendicular direction. okay, so that's the definition of R. I will also need later, and I could have, I can take here two derivatives with respect to U, and I will get the force-force correlator. So this is the potential. So and then I have the force-force correlator which I call delta so this is nothing but minus the second derivative of R. Okay. Now this is the disorder here is quench disorder, so it doesn't change in my experiment. I can redo the experiment, and actually it's reproducible. So I see the contact line going through the same configurations again and again. So and quench disorder is usually treated with replicas. I mean,
this bar means the average of the quench disorder.
Yeah, so when I write a bar, I mean disorder average, and when I write this, okay, I usually mean, should also write disorder average here. I mean this I use for terminal averages. and this for the disorder average.
Or if 2 zeta is less than
1? Zeta is less than 1. Zeta is, we will get to that.
Do you put any explicit driving in? So do you represent the fact that the thing is driven?
I will discuss this later. I mean, there are two different questions you can ask. What we saw in this experiment was a real driven system. There's one term which I have not yet written, which I will write later. I mean, there's some confining potential appearing, I can already write it here. So there's, in general, there's one. There's one additional term. Well, it's not here in easy to get for the magnet. But in general, you have a confining potential. So in the contact line, you have it. Well, you can see it in my bottle here. The contact line has an average position here. It comes from gravity. Gravity and surface tension together create this parabolic potential. In a magnet, what you could think of is you can apply a magnetic field with a field gradient. So you have a magnetic field pointing up and here, so it will align the spins as they are written here, and it will point down here, and here it's about zero. So the magnetic field grows. I mean, it's always pointing in this in the third direction here, perpendicular to the backboard, but it's pointing up here and down here, and the field strength varies linearly. If you do this, then you get exactly this term here. Well, in an experiment, it's hard to do. For real magnets, you have they're usually not easing. Like here, you use an easing magnet. You have different ways of creating approximately this term, but I don't want to get into the into this here. That's would have take too much time. Did I answer the question? And of course, this depends on some parameter W. So now, so there are two questions. Sorry, I came back to Peter's question. There are two questions you can ask. One is you look for the equilibrium position, and that's conceptually simpler, so I will be working with that. So you ask, I give W, and then I ask for the minimum energy configuration. The thermal fluctuations in these kind of systems usually play no role, or just a minor role. So I can ask, I mean, can think of minimum the minimum energy configurations of zero temperature. So it's an optimization problem I try to solve with my field theory. This is one possibility. The other possibility is I drive the system, and that's also very simple. So I put the system in some configuration, for, say, U equals zero, and then I increase W. Say I choose W being VT, T time and V the velocity. And just look what the system is doing. And then if the configuration becomes, so first it will be stable, but then it will become unstable and it will do these jumps, just the jumps we have seen. So these are two different universality classes which can be treated in the same framework. So for the conceptual simplicity, I will do the static, the discussion on the static problem. But there are small modifications only for the driven problem. Okay, so now you have to do the disorder averaging. So what you usually do is you take the partition function, you replicate it n times, and then you average over this order. I mean, you are familiar with that procedure, I guess, huh? Anybody know?
Maybe you should explain.
Okay, so if you have quenched this order, what you really would like to average is okay, let me draw on this here. So usually what you want to average is some observables O. So this observable, I mean it's you write down the partition function O, which depends on U, and then you have your energy, which depends on U. But this is not correctly normalized, so you have to divide it by the same thing, but with the O omitted. So you have to divide it by 1, the average of 1. And then you, at the end, you have to take the disorder average of this whole thing. Now, so this is something which is very hard to do, because you have in the partition function. This is just the partition function. So you have the partition function standing in the denominator, and you have to average this. So then you can do a trick, which is called the replica trick. You take you take n minus 1 more copies. So if you take one more copy, you take two copies, and you have a factor z here, and an additional factor of z here. You can do it with 3, 4. Well, you can also do it with arbitrary n, and then you forget that n was a positive integer, and you just put n to 0. So this makes that this thing disappears here. Well, I mean, this is no longer an equality. Then you have n minus 1 factors of z, and they are observable here. So you just do the calculation for n copies, and at the end of everything, you pretend that n is 0. It's a mathematical trick. So that's why I'm doing n copies. And these n copies here, I have to average over this order. Okay? You with me? So so this is, well, it's again the path integral of the generalized partition function. I mean, I sum over all u now in each copy, but we label them by alpha, I mean, it's a product. Alpha from 1 to n. And then I have, well, the elastic energy I have to sum it over alpha. Then I have, and there's a 1 over t here. Then I have the this W part, which depends on replica alpha, on copy alpha. And then I have this term here. And now I'm averaging the whole thing over this order. So this one does not depend on this order, so I'm only doing it here. And what I get out is, well, the V, I said it has Gaussian correlations. So this will give e to the 1 half, the t square. And then it's a correlation of V with itself. The correlation with V with itself is short range in x as a function r. So let me write the integral over x. So I have integral over x integral over x prime, the delta function eats up one of those. And then the function u remains. So that's what I get.
With the sum of graphs and beta.
Yes, sure. You okay with that? Some people look puzzled. Okay, you can also get a physical picture. I have my n copies, so I just look at the system n times. Well, each part has some elastic energy, that's clear. But then my disorder has, for instance, say it has one deep valley. So the different copies, I mean, they have a tendency to sit in the same valley because this is just favorable. And this looks like an attraction between these two copies, and that's exactly what you see here. So it's a term which, if you think of it in terms of energy, I mean, here's a minus, so there is a global minus. So this term is negative. I mean, function R is positive. There's a correlation function between of the potential. So it's negative. This means it's attractive, and this is just potential correlator and the attractive potential between these two copies. Okay?
I don't see the indices clearly. Where is alpha and where is beta?
Alpha and beta. It's just summed over.
So if it is
alpha and beta, yeah,
if it is the same replica, if both are alpha, then
then it's just a number. You can.
It's only off
this
diagonal.
Only off diagonal are important. Yeah.
So you sum from alpha and beta both from 1 to n, right?
Yes.
Then you take n equal to 0, n going to 0.
At the very end, yeah.
So you are saying you take that coupling between this going to the 0 limit. That coupling you are saying between the two different states. That and then you take that attraction to zero.
No, it's just the number of copies. Don't think. I mean, this is just a technical thing. This n to zero. Think of n equals two, and you don't lose anything.
These sort of things done because you're taking the average of the log z, and you take the n going to zero. But
yes.
You can also kind of interpret these sort of averaging as time average, like.
Yeah, so there is a different way of looking at this. You can write down the equation of motion. This you would do for the dynamics. So you write down u dot of x and t, so this is the time derivative, equals, so there's minus Laplacian, Laplacian of, let me not confuse this. So the Laplacian of...
I didn't want to start discussing the dynamics now, but what I'm asking is, can we interpret this sort of correlation as a time correlation also in the long time limit? In other way, in spin glass, such correlations can be interpreted.
Yeah, okay, so you could take this, you could take alpha and beta, I mean, you take two different copies, and you take them infinite time separate. And then finally, I mean, so you run the Langevin equation, and then you take the limit t to zero. But you first take the limit time difference.
Not t going to zero, t going to infinity.
The time difference little t to infinity, and then you take the capital T, the temperature, to zero. That's the procedure. Okay. So this interaction would be the same copy at two very distant times. Okay, so that's theoretical modeling. I could also do it on the Langevin equation using some Martensitzer rows. Let's not get into that. So just to give you some idea what the orders of magnitude of this exponent here, zeta, might be. There's a rather simple argument you can do. What I already said is that in general, x could be a d-dimensional coordinate. So here's, of course, d equals 1, and my movie was d equals 1, but if you have a three-dimensional magnet, d would be 2. So the domain wall, two-dimensional domain wall. And u could also have n components. So here, of course, it has one component, the movie, it has one component. But if you think of a vortex lattice, so these are lines in three dimensions, and they if you have no disorder, they arrange in a triangular lattice. Now you can deform these lines, and you can, of course, you can deform it in two directions. So this n would be two-dimensional. You can also describe a charge density wave with it. Then n would be one dimension, but the disorder is periodic. So all this is in there. So Flory estimate, well, you say you balance these two terms. It's just a power counting argument. So you say gradient u square should scale like v. But how do I characterize v? I mean, it's characterized by the correlation function. So I take the square root of the vv correlator. So this goes like, there is, it's an energy. So there's an integral. So it's l to the d minus 2 u square. And here you have L to the D from this integral. Then you have the delta function. So under the square root, you have L to the minus D. And then if this is, say, a short-range function, this would go like U to the minus N. Let me just write minus gamma. So gamma equals N would be our short range. So this function is short range, for instance, the Gaussian. So if you solve this, you find that u scales like L to the 4 minus d over 4 plus gamma, which gives you a zeta, which is 4 minus d over 4 plus n for random bond disorder. Random bond disorder, remember, this was when I had a bond here, say broken or changing, I come to this, which means that the potential VV is short range correlated.
Just one question, this m there, that's the system dependent parameter, right? The m, yeah.
This? Yeah, this is
that's a mass, right?
That's a mass. So this is experimentally measurable. I can also calculate it for the contact line problem. It's something which contains the surface tension. Well, it's essentially the inverse capillary length, which concerns surface tension and gravity and density. Yeah, that's what it contains.
Depending on temperature.
Sorry?
Depending on temperature.
It does not depend on temperature. Well, okay, I mean, as surface tension depends on temperature, I mean, it's...
You are taking it temperature independent in the theory.
Yeah. I just put the values which are relevant for the range of my, for the temperature which my experiment is done at. And for the contact line problem, the capillary length is astonishingly always about 2 millimeters. Whether you take the isobutanol at room temperature or you take liquid hydrogen, it's always about two millimeters. So so this would be inverse of 2 millimeters. Then you can have random field disorder. So I didn't discuss this in detail. If you have random field disorder, say you have a frozen end spin here. So what you, and another one here. So the potential which you see is, I mean, there is an energy gain from this spin here with this, and of this spin here with this frozen end spin. So the total energy gain is the sum of what happens in this whole column. So this is not so, I mean, this is a long range object. So if you want to get the short range, you just take the one derivative. So the force will be sensitive. The forces interface will be sensitive of whether there is a frozen end spin or not. So it's a force-force correlator, which is short range, and not the potential-potential correlator. So if the force-force correlator is short range, well, you take two derivatives here, and you can do this exercise. What you get out is that this changes to 2 plus n. So for the random field disorder. And this is a very robust result. So, I mean, for the domain wall, you have a 3 here. And this result for the static problem is actually exact. This result is a not too bad approximation, but it's certainly not exact. Okay. Now you use the field theory I've written down here, and you get to some rather mind-boggling result, which is called dimensional reduction. So this is some it's a
before you get mm-hmm. The Flory argument, because you would say, hey, why don't we stop here, right? Because we get the result which is exact. So why
only for random?
Yeah,
only for random
is good enough. But for the avalanches, for instance, is there any prediction from simple arguments like this, or do you have to go through the field theory to get good predictions for avalanches, for instance?
So
is there a prediction that's wrong from Flory?
Everything is wrong from Flory except this for random field.
Yeah.
And you only get this one exponent.
One is also reasonably good.
Yeah, but the avalanches are not well described in Flory.
So Flory doesn't, I mean, it's just this dimensional counting. It doesn't say anything about avalanches. There is, I will get to this, there is a mean field model of avalanches, which is kind of domino model. You imagine having the dominoes and you flip over one domino, it falls, and it either triggers 0, 1, or 2 dominoes. So each of these dominoes triggers again 0, 1, or 2 dominoes. If you solve this model, and you get some, you get some result, which is, an avalanche size exponent for small avalanches is avalanche size to -3/2, and you have an exponential tail at large avalanche sizes. This is what I will find in what is the mean field limit of the field theory. 4 dimensions. Well, okay, I mean, I will get to why 4 dimensions is special later. But then, this is not not good in three dimensions or in two dimensions. And there are corrections, they come from loop corrections, and you have to take all those into account to get something more reasonable. There's no Flory for that. So now dimensional reduction. Dimensional reduction is a rather formal statement. So if you look at the thermal average this is just, well, it's proportional to temperature, and then it goes like distance to the 2 minus dimension. Well, that's, I mean, it's just because this, in absence of disorder, this is just a free theory, so the propagator is 1 over k square, actually t, this t here, t over k square. You do the Fourier transform, and then you get this. So I mean, in Fourier transform, this is t over k square. This is a momentum vector. This is a rather trivial result. Now, dimensional reduction claims the following. It claims that the same two-point function disorder averaged is this thing here times x to the 4 minus t. So first the amplitude, instead of having temperature, you have here the leading expansion and leading Taylor expansion of this function. And here you have, instead of 2 minus t, you have 4 minus t. I mean, graphically, if this is a propagator, here you would have a free propagator, which is t over k square. You have another one, t over k square here, and then you have this vertex here sitting in the middle, which comes with a 1 over t square, so the t's go away. It's 1 over k4. If you Fourier transform, you get x to the 4 minus t. Now here it's a rather trivial statement. I mean, even the result is very trivial. It also is a statement which can be made on spin systems, for instance, random field systems. You can prove in quote, for using supersymmetric methods. That's the most beautiful. You can inspect the perturbation expansion diagrammatically. Well, that's always what you get naively. I'm not going to do this because the result is physically wrong. So let me put a big wrong here, even though it's formally correct. And the reason why it's wrong, well, we will see this later. It has to do with the fact that the function R, if you cross grain it, so you do renormalization, requires some non-trivial feature, namely some non-analyticity at zero. But we will see this in a moment. Now I have to identify the
ask what would happen to the dimensional reduction argument if you started with an R that already had a singularity like e to the minus modulus of u minus u prime.
Mm-hmm. Well,
then the second derivative doesn't even exist. What happens then?
Then you couldn't prove the you could no longer prove dimensional reduction. Mm-hmm. Because dimensional reduction, informally, you Taylor expand. I mean, you create vertices, you Taylor expand to all orders, and you see that all the higher vertices somehow disappear. Now you can't even do the expansion. So Larkin identifies a scale, so you have disorder energies which scale like L to the R to the d over 2, let's just here the this delta function, which gives this scaling. I mean, it's central limit theorem if you want. Typical if you average the energy over over a volume, it's square root of volume is a typical size. And then you have the elastic energy, which goes like L to the d minus 2. Well, and this with some prefactors which I didn't put there, and this equating these two quantities gives you what is called the Larkin length. So that will be the critical length. Now, what is interesting for me in this argument is I want to know this order in elastic energy, which is dominating at large distances. So if I go in four dimensions, I see they both scale the same way. So d equals 4 is a critical dimension. If I'm above four dimensions, this guy wins. If I'm below four dimensions, this guy wins at large scales. So for instance, I go in three dimensions, here I have 3/2, and here I have 1. So this guy is winning. So this order is relevant at large scales, at scales beyond the Larkin scale. And I can also look at the scaling of temperature. So temperature scales like L to the theta, and theta is d minus 2 plus 2 zeta. Where do I get this from? Well, I just look at this term here. Where is it here? The elastic energy. So L to the d minus 2 plus 2 zeta, that's what's standing here, and it comes with a 1 over t. Well, so if I go through this, that's what I get. So if d is, I mean, if theta is larger than 0, then temperature is irrelevant, meaning that, I mean, the temperature is, of course, it's a microscopic parameter I fix, but the effective temperature at
it's minus t, isn't it?
Sorry?
Is it minus t? L to the minus t.
What I say that this must be a number here, so then I get that.
Well, it's irrelevant if theta is larger than 0.
Theta larger than 0, it's irrelevant. Okay, so I mean, it is, for instance, let's put in here this domain wall, or let's think of something which you may know of another system, the directed polymer. The directed polymer has dimension 1, so it's 1 minus 2, and roughness of 2/3, so this will give 2/3 to theta, so it's irrelevant. So I can look, I can pretend that temperature is 0. An example where I couldn't pretend this is if I go in two dimensions and I have zeta equals 0. Zeta equals 0 I have for the charge density wave, because there is, I mean, since it's a periodic function, I can't rescale it. So this would be the marginal case. Okay. Now, now I come to the functional RG part. RG stands, of course, for renormalization group, or FRG. Now, my function R of U well, it starts off with a constant. Well, then you subtract the constant. And then the term which interests me is u square, and then since it's an even function, I will have something like this, and it goes on. So now I have identified my the dimension 4 as the critical dimension, and well, I have also the dimension reduction argument, which tells me that in four dimensions I have a dimensionless field. It goes like x to the 4 minus d, and d equals 0. So in four dimensions the field is dimensionless. This will this argument breaks down when I get non-trivial corrections, but in the and this limit it's still is still correct. So here I have so say this is the coupling constant of my system, which comes with u square, dimension 0. This is another coupling constant of my system, which comes with u4, and has also dimension 0. So they have actually the same scaling dimension. And this also holds for the higher terms I have not written here, the u6, u8, which means there's no sense in just Taylor expanding that and just keeping the first terms, as one often is doing when one uses field theory. For instance, the famous phi 4 field theory, well, you take phi square, which is a mass, and phi 4, which is the interaction, and phi 6 you drop. Well, this works because you're expanding also around four dimensions, but the field in four dimensions has dimension 2 minus d over 2, so it's minus 1 half in my units. So it's so the higher vertices can be dropped. Here I can't do that, so I have to keep the whole function R. And now I'm going to write you the functional RG equation, the RG equation to leading order, to one loop order, and then I try to motivate it. If I were to derive it carefully, it would take me well, half an hour just to go through all the steps. So I will do some motivation, and we can discuss this in private, or I can give another seminar on this. So let me write you the basic equation. So it's a flow equation for R of U. So I have some rescaling parameter, which I call L. So you can think, if you're familiar with Wilson, this is a notation which is inspired by Wilson method. And also this is already some effectively rescaled, so this is a dimensionless coupling in this order correlator. So I should put tildes, but for the simplicity of notations I won't do this. So there's a first term which I have at my disposal, which comes from just these rescalings I have mentioned. It's essentially, you see here is this combination. T has a certain dimension, which I have written here, and R. So there is a combination which has no dimension. This comes from here. And epsilon, I should also say, epsilon is 4 minus d. Well, it measures the distance to the critical dimension. And zeta, I said, is a roughness exponent. Well, if the field requires a dimension which is not 0, it's 0 in dimension 4, then I have to rescale this, and this gives rise to this term here. So these are the two simple terms everybody is probably not too surprised to see. And then come two non-trivial terms. Which are these here.
L is the derivative you are taking.
Sorry?
L. L, right?
Yeah, so L is probably minus log of the mass, for instance. Some scale, or you take the ultraviolet cutoff, log of the ultraviolet cutoff.
R depends on that, right?
And R depends on that. I didn't say how I think about how I physically think about randomization. I will come to that later. So, can you just, this is the RG parameter. I mean, it has a physical meaning. I explain this later.
Maybe it's a bit confusing that though that you're keeping the same notation for the bare R and for the renormalized one. So yeah.
If you want, I put U tilde. So.
Yeah.
So this is a renormalized one, and this is the bare one.
And the U is also rescaled.
And the U is also rescaled. Yeah, that's what you see here.
The independence is coming because you are writing the bare R in terms of the rescaled variable. So when you are renormalizing R, you are rescaling the variables with factor L. So that's where the independence of R is coming, right?
Yeah, so I'm rescaling the field. All right. Let's say I would have to work out the sign. And then the argument is U. Well, okay. So there are two rescaling factors like this in the definition.
Have you already taken the replica limit, or you've already taken n to zero?
This is in that limit, yes. So now let me open a parenthesis and tell you how you can imagine getting terms like this. So you know in 5-4 theory you have just a coupling. You would have a coupling and you would have your rescalings, whatever. Then you have the coupling square here. But actually if you do 5-4, you do it with a potential V of phi instead of phi 4. So you generalize this. The equation you would get, well, I don't write the rescaling terms, but what you would get is why can't I buy this chunk? Is the double prime of phi square. And graphically, so you have the vertex V. I mean, you have as many legs as you want going out, and you have another one, as many legs as you want going out. And the diagram you draw is this one. Well, which is a combinatorial thing. I mean, if you have phi to the n here, you okay, all sides are the same. There's a factor n to grabbing the first outgoing phi. I have something similar here. And then I lose a phi, and then I do the procedure a second time. But you remark that this combinatorial factor is nothing than taking the derivative of phi. If phi is, if v is phi to the n, then what is usually in this Wick contraction, the combinatorial, is just taking a derivative. So if you do it on 5-4 theory, kind of theory, I mean with a general function, you get, because you're drawing a diagram with two lines going out from each vertex, you get a second derivative. The same on the bottom here. Well, the same structure is happening in my theory. I mean, that's exactly the same term here. The term which is not there in 5-4, it's this one here. And this comes about because you can... let me draw the two guys in question. So you have one R and a second R. So this is one replica, this is another. So U of alpha. And then you can contract it like this. So this would at the end be a replica alpha and beta. It's exactly the same form. These two replicas are identified. And this guy would be something like this. So this is the same replica, both alpha. So it's U alpha minus U alpha. Remember the form. U alpha minus U alpha. It's zero. So that's what this zero is here. Well, this guy just doesn't get touched, so it's the R. And then you have, well, as you see, you have two outgoing lines from each vertex, so it's also the second derivative. Okay, I close the parenthesis. Who wants this in more detail? I can explain this. Just to give you a flavor, okay? So this is the basic equation which we are using, which describe the Ramazation. Now, let me analyze this equation for you. And I can write down, to do this, I write down the flow of the first non-trivial moments. So this would be epsilon minus 2 zeta, a second of 0, plus our third square, and this is epsilon r fourth plus our third, our fifth, or zero. Okay. Now, well, we haven't. I should have maybe made a drawing of R here. So let me do a drawing. So this would be R, and it's a symmetric function, of course. So the odd derivatives are zero here. So those guys here, this one and this one, I just throw out. And then I have a rather simple equation here, which is linear. I can solve. I mean, it's, if I look for a fixed point, this is only zero. If this is zero, from which I can read off that zeta is epsilon over 2. Epsilon, remember, is 4 minus d over 2. And this is already a result we know. It's this one here, the dimension reduction result. We also know it's wrong, so we get to that point shortly. Then you have the equation for the fourth moment. There is a linear term, which is not very interesting, but you have a quadratic term. So you have essentially an equation which is the flow of the fourth derivative is the fourth derivative squared. And then you know that these kind of equations, they blow up. So r fourth of 0, and the solution would be something like 1 over 1 minus r. Okay? Or you just try, you plug it in, you take the derivative, respect to r, you get a 1 over 1 minus l square, well, which is also this term square. Okay? So if l hits 1, then you have a divergence. So it's a finite R G time divergence. And this scale, which I should put the scale here, the scale I have not written is actually the Larkin scale. I mean, that's a scale which we have identified here. I mean, physically, it's this scale. What happens at this scale? Well, R fourth of zero is becoming infinite. So I have something which is smooth. I always think of a Gaussian. I run this equation, so I know that I have something which has a curvature which grows. It grows more and more. So So we get something with an infinite curvature, which looks like this.
It's the second derivative that you're drawing here.
Thanks. So I'm drawing the second derivative here, the force-force correlator. So this one has an infinite curvature. So that's a cusp singularity in the force-force correlator, which means also that if you look at the third derivative, which is this function I call delta, so it's delta prime. So this is no longer zero. So this takes a positive value if you take the continuation from here to zero, which is the only thing to make well-defined the derivative at zero. But of course, you have to tell me I have to tell you from which side I want this derivative to be taken. This term here, remember we had dropped it due to this parity argument. We said r is an even function, so r third is an odd function, so it must vanish at zero. The correct interpretation is that I can no longer drop this. So I have to take this object here, which has a finite value, and I have to plug it into this equation if I want to solve all this consistently. But this is very good. This is what we actually need, because now this term is no longer zero. I mean, you have to balance this term with this term here. So it means it gives you a mechanism out of this dimensional reduction, which is such a strong technical tool, which always gives you all your magnificent calculations telling you zeta is just epsilon over 2. This term here kills dimensional reduction. So the cusp is very important for killing dimensional reduction. Now, how do you solve then? I explain why I get a cusp. Now I have to solve this equation here, and that's not too difficult. That's a question.
You also need to keep the very last term in the equation for R4 then.
Which is the very last term?
Yeah, you kind of third times the fifth derivative. Given there is also
singular. Yeah. So the analysis I did here was being in the phase which is the smooth phase, and I want to identify the singularity. That's correctly done by what I've done. If I want to go further, it's no longer a good idea in looking at derivatives. I should look at the full function, especially what I can do. I can look for fixed points of my function. So I said d all r tilde equals zero. Well, I have to solve this equation. How do I do it? Well, it's easier to think in terms of delta. So I take delta and I choose a value of delta at zero. There's some rescaling invariance here, which I don't want to explain, which allows you to do this. And then you choose, and then you have, you still didn't know anything or say anything about zeta. You choose zeta. If you choose zeta, you get a slope here by analyzing the equation around zero, and then you go a little bit away and then you run numerical integration of this equation, and in general it will give you something like this, and then it will explode. So meaning that this explodes indicates that, well, it's not a solution because your physical disorder decays to zero at infinity. So this is a boundary condition. It's the same thing if you want to solve in quantum mechanics the eigenvalue problem. There's only certain eigenvalues for which you have the wave function decaying to zero. And the eigenvalues are the following. So if I do this on delta, so I have a first solution. This is the so-called random field solution. I mean, it's one relevant for random field disorder. It looks like this. Then, again, doing it on delta, I have a random bond solution. And you can already guess what will happen from the next eigenfunction in quantum mechanics, so it's something with a one knot. And that's a solution for random bond. Random bond means that the force can be gotten as a derivative of a potential, which means that the integral over the force from minus infinity to plus infinity must be zero, which means that this area here, I mean, these areas have to match up, so the total integral is zero. This is random bond. And the random periodic, my charge density wave, I have a period from 0 to 2 pi, and the solution is just a parabola. So these are the three main solutions, and I can have a power law tail in my microscopic disorder, when I also keep this power law tail in my renormalized disorder. I'm not going to draw this. So these are the three universality classes, and I have solved the eigenvalue problem, so I get my zeta. Here I get zeta equals epsilon over 3. Well, that was the same thing as Flory. I put now n always to 1. And this is actually a result which in the statics is correct to all orders. So if you have two loop corrections, this result is not changed. Random bond, I get zeta equals 0.2083 epsilon, and then, well, there's also epsilon square terms if I'm courageous enough to do the two loop calculation. This is Flory, 0.2. It's not correct, and of course, so there are two loop corrections which increases even more. Yes?
Usually, when Flory argument becomes correct, it means that there is some cancellation. So it gives you a fortuitous result. And where are the cancellations? Is it obvious here?
When I can prove it on the RG equation, you just have to look at the how does it work? I think you have to take one derivative and integrate the equation from minus infinity to infinity, and this all this stuff. Well, I take one derivative and integrate, so this goes to zero. This reduces this to epsilon minus 3 zeta. One term from here, and then the condition is epsilon equals 3 zeta, which comes out there. So it's a rather general structure on this equation. It is not true for the pinning. So I didn't talk about the pinning at all. So this is the statics. I mean, these three fixed points are for the statics. If you do a driven dynamics, this fixed point, so in the driven dynamics, this fixed point goes over to the random field class. You start with random bond disorder and then you get to random field disorder, effective random field disorder at large scales. The idea is, I mean, if you drive your interface, the thing is pinned and then you move it a little bit, so it only sees the disorder which you just in front of you, and it has forgotten the whole history, so it can't distinguish between random bond and random field. You can also see it formally at two loop order in the RG equation. Yes.
Is it like, you know, you're getting these three different kind of fixed point behavior as you tune the strength of this quenched impurity, like the VV, this relation that the PV coefficient in the QR.
Now, this statement I made here is a consistency statement. If I want R to decay in a certain, I want R to decay in a certain way, then there are only certain solutions possible. If I demand it to decay, R to decay exponentially, then this is the only solution. If I demand the second derivative of R to decay exponentially, but not R itself, then this is the only solution.
But this is independent of the strength of the quenched impurity?
Yes. I can start with very weak disorder. Starting with very weak disorder just makes my Larkin scale larger. So, I mean, it's the same equation, just the seed is smaller. So you have to wait longer time until you see something non-trivial happening.
Well, the fixed points are attractive.
The fixed points are attractive.
The whole phase is described by one non-trivial fixed point.
And it's, the strength of the method is that there are only very few fixed points, with each a gigantic basin of attraction. So if you tell me the microscopic disorder, I tell you which fixed point it is. So any random bond disorder, well, that's this fixed point here in the magnet. Any random field disorder in the magnet, you get to this fixed point. Random bond, just a tiny little bit of random field, well, it's the random field, you go to this fixed point. Okay?
So how do you decide in the experimental system whether it is random bond or random field?
Well, in a magnet, I think you have an intuition.
For the water?
For the water, so as I said, in the driven system, you don't see this fixed point. So now in RG, you always go to this. So this is the relevant one.
If you look at the kind of higher order eigenfunctions of your steady state equation, do they correspond to any physics?
This would be multi-critical points.
So you're very specific initial.
Yeah. I mean, the disorder correlators, I mean, not, they must be, I don't even know what I can produce it. Well, let's discuss this. Okay, so I solved this equation. I told you that it acquires a cusp. I told you it's necessary to get beyond dimensional reduction. What I should explain is why the physics is demanding a cusp. And you can say, okay, just an artifact of your equation, your method, that's just some garbage coming up. I mean, some R4 is a coupling constant, and this coupling constant goes to infinity. That's usually when our friends from the high energy community tell us, just forget about your method, it's not working. So I have to make sure that this is really the physics I'm after.
Just one question. I mean, even from that simpler question, does the physics require really that you need to have you would have the fixed point that you have scaling in such systems. Is that required from the physics, or is just you see the fixed point from the calculation? You know, in critical phenomena, it's an established fact that you see experimentally the scaling and scaling hypothesis, and then from the analysis when you see the critical the fixed point exists, it kind of scaling follows from it. In this kind of system, is it obvious that scaling should help?
Well, it's the same reasoning as for the critical points. You see this scaling in experiments, and you see it here. Okay, so now what I said I have to do, I have to minimize the total energy, being the sum out of these three terms. Now let me do a toy model because it's much easier to draw. But everything I say, you can think of say this domain wall if you want. The toy model is just a point which sees some disorder. So I'm dropping this term apparently, and I'm keeping this and this term. Well, the first argument is no longer there because I'm one point. So and this will look like this. So I have my random potential. Well, and I want some quadratic potential. So I put a particle here and I attach it with a spring to some external point W. Well, of course, here I have some geometrical effect, I mean, as I have drawn, but you couldn't arrange of really attaching it with a parabola. But this doesn't make any difference in the argument, so I'm not discussing this. Now, what I want to do is I move this external point W over and again ask, what is the minimal energy configuration? It's still here. But when I get to this point here, there's a rather special point. This point, you can either have a solution here, or you can have a solution here. Now I can plot the total energy, v-effective, or we call it v-hat, a function of W. I plot it. So, I mean, if my disorder is not too smooth, but it has a little wiggles, then I know that the particle almost not move. So the contribution from the disorder will not change. So what I have is only the contribution from the spring, and the contribution from the spring is a parabola. Well, that's true until to this point. Then I'm getting something from this this position here, but it's again a parabola. So what I get is something like this. Parabolas and, well, the upper part I have to throw out, so I have just to take the absolute minimum. And that's how my potential looks like. Well, you can take a derivative with respect to W, so you get the force. So the force will look, I mean, it's decreasing around here. I mean, the force goes in this direction. The force on this on the particle goes in this direction, so it's decreasing. So up to this point, it's decreasing. Well, then I have a new force because of a new position. So I have a jump in force, and I again have something decreasing. And if this is approximately a parabola, this is approximately linear. Okay, well, didn't draw it correctly. So that's what I'm seeing, okay? Now let me calculate the correlator for you. And to simplify matters, I'm looking at this object here. F of W minus F of 0 square. Well, suppose I take one point or W prime. So I take W and W prime here. And this means averaging over disorder. But you can also think of translationally averaging. So I do this here, and then I do it up to the parking garage. So if I'm here, well, there's some certain slope, which well, we can put to 1. That's just, well, it's the strength of the parabola. So it's actually m square. And then it's this distance, so it's W minus W prime. And the whole thing square. That's what you would expect from situations like this. But then, of course, there are more dramatic contributions when you have a jump in there. So let's put one point here. and one point here. Now you have a finite contribution, which is, you have a jump of a certain size. Let me call this jump size S. It's my avalanche size, remember? This is S, my avalanche size. And since I have here the difference squared, it's actually S squared. That's a jump. Well, and then what is the term which stands here? Well, it's just the probability to have a jump. And the probability to have a jump is, of course, larger if I have the 2 points larger apart, and it's going to zero if the 2 points are sitting together. And, it's just the size of this window. So it's W minus W prime. Okay? So this term, of course, dominates over this one. So we can forget about this one. And there are some normalization constants which I just threw out. And this is actually really an average already of a second avalanche size moment. But what you see is that the force-force correlator, and this is nothing but delta of 0 minus delta of W, starts with a linear term, which is nothing but the statement that the function delta has a cusp at zero. That's what I've drawn here, okay? So my argument is valid for this region. And then I see the nonlinear terms coming. So it's actually, if I have an experiment which shows me this signal, there's nothing I can do but having a delta, a force-force correlator looking like this. So this is the very physics of my system showing up. Okay, you still with me? Now, there's something I can do, which gives me some additional radiation, because now I'm looking at the force-force correlator. I want something which is simple to look at in the experiment. And what I'm doing is I just take the derivative, the function derivative of this equation with respect to u. So I ask, if I'm at some local minima, well then this, I can change my u a little bit, and it must be, so the derivative must be zero. So dH by du must be zero. Well, I can do this. This is minus Laplacian of u of x plus m square u of x minus w plus du b of x and u of x. Now, I have certainly the right to integrate this equation over space. So the first term, Laplacian integrated over space, this goes away. This, well, let me call this m square, well, I have a volume factor, u of w, well, it's uw minus w. So that's the center of mass position. So the displacement of the center of mass position from the minima of the parabola with this term here. Well, this is just gives me the 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 effect, I mean the renormalized effective force on the interface. So here I have a very nice relation that the force exerted on my interface is nothing but the displacement of the center of mass, the center of mass from the wall center. So I can use this to replace F in the definition of a delta, and now I get this very nice equation for what delta means physically. So delta, and this is really the renormalized. Remember it here I had argued on the effective this is the effective potential, effective force. Now, which I also call the renormalized disorder. This is like this. And I've done a pseudo derivation that what we have in the feed theory is doing exactly the same thing as what we had for the particle. Okay, this is I fudged over this, but this can be proven, and it's a consequence of some symmetry in the problem, which is called the statistical tilt symmetry. You can tilt the interface, and it doesn't. So if you tilt the interface, there's no contribution from the disorder term. There's only the explicit contributions here. So you can thinking of tilting the interface once in the macroscopic model and once in the renormalized model. So we get the same. You get the same contribution. So imagine the elastic constant would have renormalized, then it would have gotten two different contributions, which tells me there is no renormalization of the elastic constant and of the mass. So these are microscopic parameters which remain unchanged. And this is behind this statement here, that indeed the renormalized effect disorder can be measured in an experiment like this. Now let's see what let me give still a different interpretation how you can think of this. I can think of this, and RG has a parameter, the L, and I sit here. Well, I want this to be thought of as a logarithm of my mass. So think of the following experiment. I start with a parabola for my interface, which is very, very narrow, okay? Well, what does the interface do? A very narrow parabola, the interface is just straight. So the disorder you see, it's spatially averaged, but it's exactly at the same position I'm prescribing by the minima of my wall. Well, that's what we usually call the microscopic disorder. Now you open your parabola, and it will still sit in there. At some point, it will find a better configuration somewhere away. Well, this scale already is an interesting scale. It's a Larkin scale. If I'm at scale smaller, so where I have a very definite position of my interface, which just through elasticity is slightly deformed, but I have not this metastability which I have used to derive the cusp. Well, then I'm in the smooth scale, and the dimension reduction, for instance, would hold. Well, then I come to the regime when I open the parabola where I see multiple minima. That's the scheme when the domain where I have to apply functional RG to get a qualitative and quantitative correct description. So now I open my parabola, and I see more and more of these minima, and this is exactly what happens here. You can derive this equation here in the way you derive it. You need some regulator in the diagrams, and if you use the mass, this mass here, That's exactly the equation you get. Now, but this mass is also the has also the physical interpretation of opening up my wall. So, well, all this is the same, which also tells you that this is really the renormalized disorder at the given mass, at the given opening of my parabola. The opening of the parabola is my renormalization scale. Okay? So this can be measured, and should I try to show you the result? I try to show you a result for the hydrogen cesium experiment. Before going to the avalanches. Okay, now here's the numerical experiment. You can of course do this in the computer, do the experiment with the parabola, and this virtual this computer experiment. And here you see theory. These are the solid lines, one loop, two loop for the depending transition, and the diamonds are the numerical results. So I don't want to go into the details. This fits rather quantitatively. You see here the one loop errors are 1%, and this is a data, and this is a as far as you get to two loops. So this is the distance, I mean the error which you still have a two loop order. Just that you have an idea, I mean that this is really the fixed point form which he found in, as a solution of the shooting, solving the FRG equation is really what you see in the simulations. Here you have the raw data from the experiment, hydrogen cesium and easy butanol on silicon, and you can also compare this to functional RG. You have of course the statistical errors in the experiment, but in general it fits quite nicely. There's a slight problem still in the experiment. It's a little bit rounded here. It's hard to see if you look at the first derivative in functional G. I should have put this on the graph. Just goes up here and will hit approximately where the L of renormalized is sitting. So at small distances, the experiments have a little curve over, which reduces if you reduce the velocity in the experiment. This is a reduction of always a factor of 10 in driving speed. So just to give you an idea that this is really something real and not what they just a theoretical construction, and it's using nothing but this prescription here. This is an observable, of course, which is, I mean, it's the easiest to measure in an experiment. But just take the photo of their contact line and they average it, and then that's already this object here. To measure roughness carefully is much more evolved business. You are usually get between half a decade and one decade. And okay. Now, how much time do I still have? I wanted to say something.
Minus 45 minutes.
Okay. Should I take 5 or 10 minutes to explain avalanches?
Yeah.
Because that's what you came for. So. Otherwise, I would feel like cheating you. Okay, so, the idea is rather simple. So, this jump here, is my avalanche. This is the avalanche size, this difference here. And I've already calculated for you the second moment of the avalanche size distribution. It's here. And well, I mean, maybe let me just rewrite this. So I had said UW minus W minus UW prime minus W prime. To the power 2, that was S square average. Well, of course, there's some normalization, okay? Which I've not discussed. That's, well, that's I had said, and okay, I use here, I had written it for the force. And I use that the force I can rewrite as UW minus W minus UW minus W. So that's how I get this relation. And of course, higher moments. So if I want the cave moment, I just have to calculate this.
So we have like a mod W minus W prime to the K on the light.
I should write this. There's no to the power of k. It's, you want to have this, and it's the probability to have this event in your window times the moment of this event. So and then, okay, I mean, it goes, the terms I've neglected are of this order. So I just have to be able to do this. Okay. So k equals 2. Let's just repeat this. So I had my, let me do some graphical notation. So this was my disorder correlator R. If I pull two legs, I get the force correlator, so the second derivative. So this would be delta of W. One is W, one is W prime. Well, now I branch this to external points. So this would be this external point, and this the same with W prime. Well, branching means I use a correlator of the theory, of the free theory, and do this kind of contraction. You approximately see what I mean, or this is just a graphical interpretation of this here. I mean, doing perturbation theory. My perturbation theory is in the disorder vertex. The disorder vertex is a function. I can take derivatives of. I mean, I can use Vic. Big theorem, it's the same as I did in this derivation here. So I said I pull two legs and I get R second. So R second is nothing but delta. You have pulled two legs. And the two legs I contract with the external fields using a simple propagator. So this is what I get here. So what I, and then I can, these external points I can either sit at W or at W prime. For simplicity, let me put this to zero. So this would be, just write the coordinates. So one can, they can either sit at W or zero. So I would get delta of W minus delta of zero. I have two, well, it's the other way around, zero minus W. And this now I expand, I Taylor expand. This is 2 minus 2 delta prime of 0 plus times W. Write it this way. This is negative, the derivative, it goes down. So this is what I get plus order W square terms. So that's how I do the first one. Now let's do the third cumulant. So now I have three external points. And I have to connect everything. So let's start connecting. That's the first thing I can do. Well, now I have to connect these. And so let me draw a third one. Or I can do one connection like this. And now I have to say what I want to do. I can, for instance, do this. Now this guy here, I've drawn three derivatives. I've drawn three fields. So this is actually delta prime, and this is delta. Now I have again to put the external points either to W or to zero. Now you have you have delta prime, which is a function which is not defined at zero. So if these are the two same points, you get into trouble. So you have to choose some order of the points. You have to slightly move them apart, and then to convince yourself that it doesn't depend on the order in which you're doing it. But what you get out delta prime of W times W, delta of W or zero minus delta of W. That's a delta prime, and that's the delta here. And now I have, again, I'm looking for the term of order W, which I will get out here. So it's delta prime of 0 times W. And this term, I just need the leading order term. So this I will just set delta prime of 0. So in graphically, it means, well, I can have now higher vertices, so with three incoming legs, they always have to be read at zero. So this is my delta prime of zero. I just have to make sure that I do it correctly. And the last one sitting at the very bottom of this diagrams, I have to expand in W. Now let me still do the fourth order, and then I can suggest the generalization. So at fourth order, okay, let me just...
I think we would probably just write down the general form.
I want to show the beauty of the thing. So you still have to bear with me with the fourth order, and then
the beauty is competing at lunch.
Okay. I draw quicker. Okay, I just write two contributions you can have. Okay, this one has a delta here, delta second here, and a delta, and this is four legs going out. So one more derivative. This is delta. It comes in this combination, delta of 0 minus delta of W. Which means if I expand, this is order W square. Okay, I have one W from expanding this. Or with the bottom one, I can expand, I get a W on this. So this is not a term I want. This one I want. I have to expand here. Let me put an arrow where I expand. I mean, this vertex here. Okay, and I could have another one, which is like this. Then I expand this guy here. Now you can already see what's happening. I always have this last one. Let me draw a line. This last one has two outgoing lines, and each line is again branching onto something, which is again these. I mean, it's always a tree-like structure. So the last one branches onto a tree here or here. This as well is a simple part of a tree, or it branches on this. So now if I define z of lambda as e to the lambda my observable, so this is just a generating function for the moments. Well, what I have, the generating function is the sum of all these guys here. So I have that this set of lambda. Well, this one is not in there, so I have to write it, just this one line. And then I have this here. I have a delta prime of 0 plus after expansion. And you see, I mean, I've drawn an arrow. I can also draw. It's like pulling, expanding here is like pulling an extra line. So I get this additional factor. And then what I have here and to the both sides is actually the same object. So this is a z of lambda square. So that's my graphical resummation of these diagrams, which Peter told me not to write all of them, which you can solve. You find z of lambda having some square root with lambda in there. And so that's the exact mean field result. So there are no loops, just tree summations. These are all trees. This is the if you want formally, it's a Laplace transformed of the probability distribution function. So this gives P of s is s to the minus 3/2 e to the minus s. Or in this unit, it's this. So this is what comes also out of these toy model-like approaches, or the, if you know this ABBM model for domain wall motion in random magnets. You have an exponent tor, which is 3/2. Then you have an exponential tail here. Now, well, of course, we are interested in loop corrections, so you can. Where you can try to introduce loops, for instance, something like this. So this is a loop here. It's no longer a tree. You get additional terms here which look something like z over the integral over all k, k squared plus 1 minus 2z. There's a second one which is just the square of this one. So you get diagrams like this. You can again do the inverse Laplace transform. And then you correct this, and you correct the scaling function. And just to finish, let me show you comparison with numerics and data. So these are simulations done by Alan Middleton on a domain wall in a three-dimensional domain wall in a four-dimensional random easing model. I don't remember if it's a random bond or random field. But you see here, I mean, this is the scale clock P of S. We have taken out the leading term, the S to the minus tor. I've multiplied the with s to the tor, so the 1.25 is a tor, just to get the data. I mean, it must be a straight line for small s, and you see it is. And then in the simulation, you see this slight shoulder, and then it goes down. So what we get in the one loop correction, of course, a different exponent here. We have one term, additional term here, c is of order epsilon, so this is a term which grows like a square root. Of course, it's killed for large s, it's killed again of magnitude, and you have five orders of in s and five orders of magnitude in p of s, so this is rather expensive simulation.
The cutoff you have at large avalanches is due to the mass that you introduce in the system, right?
So the scale which sits here, which I didn't write, so Sm has a precise meaning in the field theory. It's this object here. So I mean, you can, I mean, this is defined as S square over 2S. So you go into your experiment simulation, you measure S square and S, and this gives you...
So if you're massless, you're parallel all the way.
Yes. But this gives you, sets you a scale, and in an experiment usually you find a scale. And this is exactly this object in field theory. All these relations are fully exact.
This tau is three halves.
No, the tau is it's non-trivial. I don't know what it is here. I can reconstruct this. It's not three halves. It's far from three halves. I mean, it's around. I think it's 1.05 or something like this. It's almost one. And you see here that you see the shoulder again. I mean, this. Okay, the red curve, this would be an exponential fit. So I suppose I have this e to the minus s for the tail and s to the minus some non-trivial power law for small distance, and I take the power law which is given by the experiment, by the numerics here. There are green points down to here which are hard to see. Well, two features are missing. First, the shoulder. It's not there in this function, but the shoulder is here in the RG. The shoulder is actually even a little bit larger than in the RG, but it's about two-thirds of the shoulder. And then the tail is different. So this is a fit with a... Okay, I mean, so I fit... There's no adjustable parameter if you use these definitions here. So this... If the scaling function is an exponential, and this is, instead of having exponential, you have e to the minus s to 7/6, which comes out of our one loop calculation.
You see that
the data are just sitting on top of this curve.
Yeah, but if a tau is 1, it's close to 1, then this is like 1 over f behavior, right? So it's very different from what you have there.
No, it's... S to the minus 1, but then it's an approximately exponential cutoff.
That's an exponential cutoff.
Yeah, this one is exponential. Ours, as I showed, is a slightly deformed exponential. So we have S, the leading term for large S is e to the minus S over Sm to the delta. Delta, if you go really far from four dimensions, I mean, this is one in four dimensions in the mean field limit, and it's approximately 7/6 in one dimension for the driven system. That's the strongest disorder you can make. Okay, probably I should still take one urgent question and then we should go for lunch.
How come the one loop thing works so well where epsilon is 3?
Well, it's 3 if you count on this units. If you multiply everything or divide before by 10, then you have 0.3. And you have to look at how large the change is in. This exponent here goes from 1 to 7/6, okay? You would think that's a small correction, you would trust it. And, as you see in the simulation here, here. I mean, it's really working out fine. You can it's even better if you want to compare the z of lambda, because you have always noise in P of S, so it's better to look at the Laplace transformed. So this is the dots are the so this is here epsilon is 1, so this is kind of smaller epsilon. The numerics are the dots and the one loop is just sitting on top. This is mean field. And I didn't adjust any parameters here. And there's no adjustable parameter because you have two freedoms of rescaling in P of S, which is the normalization and the scale of S. In the S direction, I rescale with this parameter I measure, so there's no adjustable scale. And then I have to normalize I mean, ideally, because I want the probability to be one, but that's not a good normalization because I have a diverging probability at small distance, so this doesn't exist. So what I'm used for normalization is I take S times probability and I demand this to be one. So the scaling function.
Now, this is a question that I don't expect a short answer. Maybe I should go do over once. But you know, in this talk, I expected this stick slip type solution, one of my noise answers. So what's the relationship to such an approach?
You think of a solid friction, or what This should be a. Well, okay, if you say 1 over F noise, you really mean that the S and the P of S goes like 1 over S.
Or self-organized criticality kind of thing.
Oh, self-organized criticality, or you talk about real experiments? And
not both.
No, it's very different things. Uh-huh. If you talk about the sandpile models, we have some results for avalanche size. Well, not for the avalanche size. Okay, I mean, the relation to this theory is rather indirect. It goes via the mapping of sandpile models to charge density waves proposed by Narayan and Middleton in the 80s, 90s. And this step is an it's not exact. I mean, there's an accept mapping to some sandpile model, but then you usually study a different one. So there's some approximation in there. We check this correspondence because, the sandpiles are then equivalent to loop-erased random walks and all this stuff. So we checked for the size exponent. Actually, in four dimensions, there's some universal amplitude correction which you can check in the theory and the numerics by Grasberger up to 2 to the 20 in size. 2 to the 20. They seem to work rather well. But, I mean, this still has to be worked out.
But, I mean, you have the correlative of the SIP motion, right? Yeah. That's kind of there in the force correlative. It's just that the experiment...
You also get an exponent... One in if you do it for mean field spin glasses, the SK model, you get P of S is 1 over S. This is a recent calculation we just finished with, Pierre Dussel and Markus Müller. You get 1 over S. And it's also a tedious calculation. You go moment by moment and you have to find a way to do this.
Why is it 1 over S then? Do you have any physical reason? Well, there's no cutoff? Or does the cutoff depend on N?
It's system size, the square root of system size, which sets a cutoff. But here, the nice thing about these manifolds is I put in a physical cutoff. I can show you also the same thing for the so these are the contact line experiments. As you see, the data are a little bit murky and a little bit rounded off, which is these are real experiments. But at least you see from mean field to one loop, and the data are not not too far from the one loop. There is certainly a correction towards mean field, but one loop seemed to be overshooting a little bit here. But the experiment has not converged. We saw that the delta doesn't come out correctly. There's some rounding still, which there are two ways of interpreting it. What probably happens is that they have a certain scale. They have a microscopic disorder. In the Ise-Butanol experiment, they take a wafer of silicon, they deposit random selenized patches. There's of course a certain correlation length, and the RG works from this correlation length of the disorder, which is the Larkin scale in this model, to the capillary length. The M here is a capillary length. I mean, for this contact line experiment, the M is very clearly, it's a capillary length. So that's the scale which we run. Then there is an additional problem because the contact line doesn't have this simple elasticity. So it's a rather complicated elasticity. So this is a wave vector. And so it's almost, I mean, at large wave numbers, it's absolute value of Q instead of Q square, which you have here. If you Fourier transform, you have Q square. So at large Q, you have absolute value of Q. But at small Q, you have this horrible function, which means, well, some minimizing geometry you have to do in order to get this. So, well, any more urgent questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your attention.